Coach, what percentage chance or what opportunity do you think that there is for a fall season, 2020 football season for your program?
You know, Marty, obviously this is not my decision, but my gut feeling is we're going to play. I do believe we're going to play. I'm almost certain that we are going to play. And you guys will agree with this. The SEC needs football. State of Louisiana needs football. Our country needs football. It's time to get going.
That's the unmistakable voice of LSU head coach Ed Orgeron. He's optimistic about college football in 2020. But the pandemic tides are not going the same way as Coach O. Today, the state of college football, who's canceled, who's constrained, and who's keeping options open, and for how long. Then an interview with Emily Applegate. The former employee of the Washington football team shared her experience of harassment in the organization. And she is the only woman thus far to give her name in doing so. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, July 20th. This is ESPN Daily. Hi, Heather. Thanks for joining me.
Sure. Thanks for having me on today.
Heather Dinich covers college football and the potential lack thereof for ESPN. So I'm so excited to have you because we're watching the college football landscape change day by day and really, as you know well, kind of hour by hour at this point. The Patriot League and the Ivy League announced they won't be playing any sports this fall, for instance. But the Big Ten and Pac-12 say they'll have in-conference football games only, but the Colonial Athletic Association is doing the opposite. They're saying its schools can only pursue independent schedules. And then, of course, famously independent Notre Dame says it's unlikely the season even starts on time. So that is a lot. But why are we seeing such a crazy range of approaches to how or even whether to move forward with the season at all?
Pablo, it's a reflection of what we're seeing nationally throughout our country. Schools and universities and campuses and commissioners have to react to the coronavirus pandemic in their particular region. And I think it's very important when you look at the Ivy League's decision, which was the very first one, why they did what they did.
Once again, our top story is breaking news. It's official. The Ivy League will not play any sports in the fall semester, including football.
And they did it because of their campus COVID-19 policies, meaning that there were restrictions on travel. There were restrictions on group sizes, no more than 25 to 50 people at some campuses, limitations on visitors. All things that when you put them together made it impractical to have fall competition. And then when you look at what the Pac-12 did, which was an extremely important decision, not just to go conference only, but to delay the start of the season.
Today, the Pac-12 announced that the fall season for several Pac-12 sports, including football, would adjust their schedule to conference-only games. They announced this.
That was a direct reaction to the coronavirus spikes in Arizona and Southern California.
From California, the first state to issue a stay-at-home order, to Arizona, among the first to relax those orders, these Western states are breaking new records for coronavirus cases almost daily.
If the season or practices were starting today in full go, USC and UCLA and the Arizona schools wouldn't be able to participate. So that's why it's such a patchwork decision-making process right now, because different things are happening in different areas of the country.
And Heather, conspicuously, the NCAA has not implemented any sort of universal plan for testing in regards to the coronavirus. But last week, Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, said this, quote, "Sadly, the data point in the wrong direction. If there is to be college sports in the fall, we need to get a much better handle on the pandemic." End quote. And like on the one hand, thanks, Mark, that's very helpful. But also it raises this other question. What is the NCAA's role in all of this, given all of these moving parts around the country?
Based in my conversations with Mark Emmert and Dr. Brian Hainlein, who's the NCAA's chief medical officer, their role is to guide, because that's pretty much all they can do. They have an amazing medical task force that is comprised of some people with quite extraordinary backgrounds. And what they're doing is they're saying, this is what we recommend for you. And when they made that announcement last week, I reached out to each of the Power Five conferences and said, hey, are you guys all planning on doing this? And the response that I got was, at the very least, we are going to try to do the 72-hour testing window. The concern with that is obviously the turnaround time. What happens if players are tested and then within that window, the time frame it takes to get the test results back, they become infected? So there are certainly still questions out there. But the other problem is, how available are the tests? That also remains a question and a concern. So all of those details you'll find from the NCAA, and then it's up to the conferences to implement them and, as most have told me, exceed them.
Do you think these conferences actually want that freedom to make these big decisions? Because number one, it seems like a very popular strategy so far, given the complexity of everything. It's been to kick the can further and further down the road.
I think they do, because that's how they have operated. We all call them the Power Five. If you ask one of the commissioners, they call themselves the Autonomous Five. They have the autonomy to do what they want, right? They still call themselves A5. As you see the Big 12 and Pac-12 make their own decisions, you have the SEC and the Big 12 and the ACC saying, well, now wait. We're not ready to do that. We want to wait as long as we possibly can. Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby told me he wants to get to a point where players are putting on helmets and shoulder pads before they make any major decisions. I mean, we keep talking about the end of the month as a benchmark, but they like that ability to work on their own terms, but also collaborate with each other so that if they can, they can preserve a game like LSU Texas.
So I actually want to dive into the SEC a little bit specifically, because some of the richest and most public faces of the sport, the head coaches, they've sometimes resembled lobbyists recently for football. I think of Ed Orgeron, the head coach at LSU, of course, who met Vice President Mike Pence this week, and he said that the country needs college football.
We're ready to play. There's no uncertainty here, I tell you that. We're focusing on having a great season, the task in hand.
So the SEC has postponed other fall sports like soccer and volleyball across country. But Heather, what are you hearing about SEC football in specific in fall 2020?
The SEC is under tremendous pressure to play football for a variety of reasons. Political reasons, fan base, you name it. There's a lot of pressure surrounding Commissioner Greg Sankey to find a way to figure this out, to get this done. That being said, the SEC is no different than any other Power Five conference out there in that, again, I go back to the medical advisory board, and I promise you, if those doctors and physicians and PhDs sitting on that board tell Greg Sankey, this is no longer in the best interest of your student athletes, you have to stop. He's going to surrender. Just like all of them will. As powerful as those five men are when it comes to college football, they are dealing with an unprecedented situation here in that there's something bigger than them.
And on that Power Five plan, the document that they created, filling that sort of vacuum left at the highest levels of the sport to create medical policies for COVID testing players, could you tell us a little bit more about that document and the template it provides?
Sure. It is extremely thorough. It goes into everything from social distancing and your basic CDC guidelines, wearing masks when you travel, all of those things, chartered planes, bus, whatever it might be, to details about protecting your officials, your game officials, because they're part of the, quote, necessary bubble around the players. The problem is, Pablo, and every athletic director across the country knows this, you can bend over backwards to comply and exceed all of these guidelines, and you can create a safe haven for these student athletes in the athletic facilities. But we are talking about 50 to 60,000 students in the general student body, girlfriends, boyfriends of student athletes, bars, you name it, whatever you do in college, right? And that document goes straight out the window because they're going to class and they're going to their favorite bar or their taco bar, you name it, and the risk just goes through the roof.
So they're trying to limit some amount of chaos, but I imagine, Heather, in your job, when you see a headline like the one from Saturday, which said 28 members of the West Virginia football program tested positive for coronavirus, it's hard not to kind of see chaos in that. What do you make of that? Is that shocking around the sport at this point, or is college football kind of numb to a headline like that?
Both. It should be shocking. It should be, because it's an indicator of what more is to come. Every single decision maker, from athletic director to commissioner to NCAA president Mark Emmert, knew there were going to be positive tests. So it should also be considered that there are these positive tests with student athletes somewhat in, I don't want to say isolation, right? But certainly not like it's going to be come late August, September, when classes and students start really coming back. But also, they're not doing team drills yet. They're not in that football experience. So that's why it should be a concern, but it's also not, because everyone expected this.
After the break, let's talk about some ways college football will look different and how likely it is that that can get kicked all the way from the fall down to the spring.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Heather, you shared a byline on a story with ESPN's Mark Schlabaugh about what a spring college football season might look like. And spring football, to be clear, has never managed to take hold in terms of popularity or viewership, although I guess the XFL, RIP, deserves a shout out here. How seriously are programs considering a spring college football season?
Well, Notre Dame athletic director Jack Swarbrick told me that they have to be prepared for it, and it has to be considered a viable option. Now, to be clear, no decision maker that I have spoken with is excited about that possibility. But a lot of what I heard from decision makers was, well, hold on a minute, Heather. It doesn't make any sense to scrap the fall and say we're going to play in the spring when no one has any idea if the spring is going to be any better as far as the coronavirus. And And you also have to consider the NFL draft. You know, I've heard that the SEC has concerns that so many of their big name players wouldn't participate in a spring season because of their draft status and it coinciding with that. Are you talking about playing at the same time as the NCAA basketball tournament? What else is going on? And then also, if you're playing March, April, May, you're looking at January, February for preseason training, which also coincides with the flu season.
Yeah, there are so many complications and obstacles you laid out there, but let's start with the NFL draft, because that's usually in April. That's the goal for any of these top players, presumably, especially someone like Trevor Lawrence, the Clemson quarterback, who's projected, widely presumed to be the number one overall pick. How much of a problem is the spring season with the NFL?
Well, my sense, based on people I've talked to, is that the NFL wouldn't budge in terms of moving its date. And it's something that college football would simply have to deal with. From a player perspective, I could certainly understand why some would choose not to participate in that season. But at the same time, those schools that are in contention for the college football playoff are usually so loaded at every position that even if Trevor Lawrence decided to say, I'm not doing this, there's always somebody else who can certainly compete for them. And people would be happy to cheer for whoever was throwing the ball at that time. But I don't know.
The other thing is just in terms of the mechanics of the decision, do you have any sense as to when the call on the spring gets made? When do they punt on autumn?
So it'll be interesting over the next 2 weeks to see exactly what decisions are made. Because if you talk to Bob Boolsby, his thought on it is you keep putting one foot in front of the other and you get as far as you can go until those medical experts determine, like I said before, hey, you can't do this. Over this coming week, I would expect the Big Ten and probably maybe the Pac-12 to announce exactly how many games they are playing. Does that mean that they'll determine if the season can start on time? I think they get a lot closer to saying yay or nay on that, because if it's going to start on time, you've really got to get into that preseason camp I was talking about the first week of August. You've got to start to do that. And if they're going to allow the players to do that, that's the time you make that decision.
Let's talk about the split season idea. So there is this possibility, there's another option, that you delay games until later in the fall, and then you resume in the spring, I suppose. What challenges does a split season present versus exclusively a fall or a spring?
Well, that's a great question. And that's certainly one thing that all of the commissioners are considering. But again, the big concern is what does it, if you have to take a break, how do you know that you can continue?
Yeah.
And remember, in order for the student athletes to participate, they have to be enrolled in at least online classes. And we haven't even...
Oh, right. There are classes to go to.
Right. We haven't even talked about what if students aren't allowed on campus, you know?
Ugh.
That all would factor into it as to what does it exactly look like on campus.
So it's a good time, I suppose, also to be very upfront about something else, too. There is a lot of money at stake here in the college football season. And for us, Heather, as ESPN employees, full disclosure, there's so much TV money to consider. Can you put some of the monetary aspect into perspective for us?
It's hard to, because each school is different. We've already seen Stanford cancel 11 sports. It's Stanford, right? It's different because the FCS schools can make this decision to cancel fall sports independently of finances, because you're talking about Harvard and Princeton that have endowments, right? And they don't depend on a TV contract to fund 20 some other sports. I think what people don't realize is if there wasn't a college football season, Even the big boys would get crushed financially. Alabama, LSU, USC, you name it. Can they survive it? Yes. But it's really hard to pinpoint how it would impact, you know, certain schools individually, but it would be awful. But they would very quickly turn their attention to making 2021 the biggest, baddest preseason college football schedule you've ever seen in your life.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt that that's exactly what would happen next. That's where the can would bounce to. Mm-hmm. But Heather, let's end on the question that none of the people you mentioned by name want to answer, which is, what do you think the likelihood is that we actually see college football in some form in either the spring or the late fall? What are the odds we get the game that so many of us want to be watching?
Pablo, I mean, all I can, anyone who tells you they know what's going on is full of you know what. I'll tell you this, based on my conversations with commissioners, my gut feeling is if they can play, they will play. American Athletic Conference Commissioner Mike Oresko told me, look, we've pretty much decided if two of our teams can't play, we're going to push on with those that can. Again, what's the line? What's the cutoff line? I'm not sure yet. So I get the sense that if they, those that can, will. Every single decision maker is saying it's going in the wrong direction.
Heather, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day of monitoring college football news to talk to me.
Thank you so much, Pablo.
Coming up, we hear from the one woman who gave her name of the 15 who've made sexual harassment claims against the Washington football team and what she thinks of the team's response.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. 15 women came forward with claims of longstanding and ongoing sexual harassment and misconduct while working for the Washington football team. And even before the Washington Post published this story, two of the men accused were fired and another of the accused retired. So the big question now is, what happens next? Team owner Dan Snyder has hired a legal team for an internal investigation. He also sent a letter, conspicuously co-signed by his wife, to employees, apologizing and promising change. Emily Applegate is the only woman whose name is attached to her allegations in that Post story. I talked to Applegate about her experience working for the team, the response to her public comments, and why she went on the record as a named source.
I've always been somebody that has no problem kind of speaking my mind and speaking out against, you know, any kind of situation that I don't find is fair. So it was easy for me in that sense. And then once I left the DC area and I moved down to Austin, Texas, I was very fortunate to find another position with the University of Texas in their athletic department. And that was a great experience for me. I enjoyed my time there, ultimately ended up leaving, but not because of a bad situation. And then I was volunteering for a nonprofit where I worked with victims of sexual assault. And these women, you know, come forward and share these stories that are, in my opinion, 10 times worse than what I experienced. And they're able to put their names out there to the police and try to, you know, file these reports. So if these people can do that, then I can do this.
So in terms of fears that you may have had of having your name out there, was there anything that crossed your mind as a concern?
Yes, actually. And it happened today. I had posted on my Instagram and my Facebook just a thank you message for, you know, everybody that reached out, because most of it was all very positive. And then there were some now negative comments about me and about my appearance. It sucks, honestly, but I am strong enough to just read it and pass by and not worry about it ever again.
For those who haven't read the story, could you just describe your time working for the team?
I started working as a part-time sales rep, and I moved from New Jersey to Washington, D.C. For like a $12 an hour job, and just struggled until, you know, I was a full-time and doing what I wanted to do. And I got to a position with the team that was my ideal job in sports. I was planning events for an NFL team, and it was going to be, you know, my dream come true. However, I didn't know that there was going to be such, you know, day-to-day negativity that I'd have to deal with. And that spanned from verbal harassment to sexual harassment, being called stupid, and in the same breath being hit on. It was a dreadful and toxic work environment that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy.
Did you end up reporting any of that behavior to the actual human resources department?
I didn't. And I know some of those negative comments, as I mentioned before, are saying that, you know, why didn't you come forward? And I didn't have that opportunity because there wasn't a human resources team in place. There was one woman, and she was a nice woman. I don't think that she had any training in human resources. There wasn't a formal way to file a complaint.
Yeah, Daniel Snyder, the owner of the team, released a statement on Friday, and he said, quote, "The behavior described in yesterday's Washington Post article has no place in our franchise, our society. This story has strengthened my commitment to setting a new culture and standard for our team." Snyder also hired a law firm to, quote, "conduct an independent review of team policies, culture, and allegations of workplace misconduct," end quote. So, Emily, I'm just curious about your reaction to the team's response so far.
I did find out through a tweet that they sent a letter to the staff now giving an apology from Dan Snyder and his wife. And that is actually what made me very upset, and along with my coworkers who had spoken out. It was a misdirected apology. They're apologizing to people that either had nothing to do with it because they weren't there at the time, or actually were there at the time and didn't do anything to stop the abuse that they saw. There are 15 women, at least, that deserve an apology. And there are countless other women that haven't had the chance to share their story about their time with the organization. They need an apology. The current staff doesn't need an apology because they have a poor PR situation at the moment. So for me, yes, you're trying to move forward in the right direction, and I hope that you do stand by that, but there are some things that you're missing.
And what are some of those other things that are missing in terms of changes you'd like to see the organization make?
One of the things is going to start with an actual human resources department. And I think that due to the media, they are going to have to do. I don't think that you can really get away with not doing that. But be a change and be an advocate. We're talking about somebody that owns an NFL team with billions of dollars. You can make such a difference if you wanted to, and if you really truly cared, you could make a difference. A lot of people sent me their speculations about what the article would be about. There were people that would tweet or say things like, oh, it's going to probably be about sexual harassment because that's known. And that's not okay. And they nailed it on the head. Like, they already knew what it was going to be about because there's this reputation of this specific team and the sports world as a whole.
And now you're studying to go to law school. And is it right that you just took the LSAT?
I just took the LSATs on Tuesday. The story dropped on Thursday, and Friday was my 31st birthday. It has been a wild week.
Wow.
It is all happening all at the same time.
And is your being named in this story the end of this story for you? Or where does your speaking out about your experience with the Washington football team in specific, where does that go from here?
I hope this momentum keeps going. I don't want this to die down, whether it's me talking about it or it's somebody else talking about it. And I hope one day that I can be practicing law and helping people in this type of situation as well and do more than I am right now.
Emily, thank you so much for spending the time with us and telling us your story.
And thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate sharing my story and continuing the conversation.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.